Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. This evening I'll be reading from one of the newer Lungpur Liam books, Santi, Peace Beyond Illusion. I'll be reading the second talk, which is called Santi. This is a Dhamma talk given to the monks and novices of Wat Nong Bapong on the 13th of December 1988, during the annual rains retreat. The practice of insight meditation, vipassana, is for the purpose of making things bright and clear, like turning on a switch to light up a room. In the light, one can see everything as it is, plainly and clearly, in accordance with its characteristics. Vipassana is the practice of developing clear seeing for the purpose of true knowledge and the ending of delusion. Its development requires determination of mind, restraint, and patience, qualities which are built upon a foundation of faith and confidence. When one's mind is determined, diligence and energy naturally follow. But if one's mind is not determined, laziness and excuses based on self-importance gain the power to drag one into decline. Before the practice of vipassana can make one's understanding bright and clear, it is necessary to establish the supporting components. In the practice, one must consider both the external conditions of one's environment and the internal conditions of one's feelings. If one doesn't consider both, then one won't make progress. As such, one might compare this practice to the work of a farmer. Farmers need to take the season, the environment, and the location into consideration in order to do their work. The crops are dependent upon the season because they require water. The rainy season is therefore the most appropriate season for the planting of rice. But the field has to be well prepared. The farmer must make it ready first. The tools and methods for working the rice fields are numerous and varied, as one can see. It takes many months of care before the rice will mature, and then much effort must be made in transforming the grains of rice into a suitable product. The work must be done carefully, according to the correct methods and appropriate techniques. The work of our practice is the same. It's important for us to understand the purpose for which we are practicing. The purpose is santi. Santi means tranquility or peace. There are other forms of happiness which are easy enough to understand. For example, building a dwelling to ward off heat and rain provides comfort for the body. This is material happiness. However, the teachings of the Buddha point towards the happiness of freedom. Freedom from attachment, freedom from the stains of delusion. When one's heart is freed from burdens and attains to purity, it rests within its own peace and tranquility. This is called santi. Santi, or peacefulness, is achieved through a process of bringing things to a state of readiness. It requires training and diligence and effort, both on the coarse and the refined level. The coarse level involves taking care of bodily conduct, manners, and speech. The refined level refers to taking care of the thoughts and feelings which arise, many of which are tainted, unwholesome, or putrid, what the Buddha called the asavas. Dealing with these requires the use of refinement. One must understand both the coarse and refined aspects and make use of methods for sifting and straining, just as with unclean water, which must be filtered. Making use of a coarse straining process will give us coarse water. But if we make use of a refined process, we will get a finer and finer product. As such, filtering with various mineral elements results in an increasingly clear water. Our practice is just the same. We must establish principles and maintain guidelines. In this place, we have a daily routine for practice. When it comes to the appropriate time in the evening, we have a bell to call us to awareness of our responsibility. It's a signal that it's time to put down other activities, both personal and group matters, which are external concerns. We cut off our various worries regarding these things. Our task now is to come and work on a more refined level. We must rely on determination of mind and the application of diligent effort. Therefore, we gather together with our minds made up. Having showered at 4 o'clock and hearing the bell, one puts on one's upper robe with one's right shoulder uncovered as a sign of respect. If one is a fully ordained monk, one places one's folded outer robe over one's left shoulder. One also brings along any other necessary requisites. One establishes a wholesome intention and a positive attitude. One's intention is to deactivate selfish views, such as various forms of laziness and unwillingness to participate. One makes the effort to trim off these negative aspects. One sets one's mind up practicing with reverence and respect, with motivated effort. But in spite of this, there may still be obstacles. However, they can only obstruct those who are weak. Those who are strong won't be hindered by obstacles, because they won't see them as matters of significance. Those who are weak or infirm may see such matters as significant, and accordingly they become obstructions. But those with a sense of momentum won't see them as such, won't give them importance, because they aren't matters which lead to internal benefit. Having come to the sala, we have made up our minds to sit. We bow to pay our respects, and then we sit meditation. We apply effort in the sitting posture. This refined posture will lead us into a state of knowing and seeing at the beginning level. Sitting, we find that there are still difficulties to overcome. At times, the body itself presents an obstacle, which the Buddha described as khandamara. As we know, the word khanda translates as groups or aggregates of which the body is one. This mara, or obstruction, then, is known as khandamara. It remains an obstacle for those who are not yet steadfast in their dedication. Feelings of weakness, sickness, fever, aches and pains, hunger, thirst, discomfort, flies and mosquitoes, heat and cold can arise. These are feelings which the weak person sees as obstructions. The strong-minded person, focused, sincere, and determined, doesn't see such things as obstacles, but as ordinary worldly matters. If we free ourselves from the conditioned realm, there will be no khandhas, and therefore no aches and pains. Aches and pains inevitably accompany the khandhas. Fever, sickness, and threats to one's health come along with this group of elements that we call the body. It's not possible to have a body without having such problems. Where would you have such things arise if not right here within the body? We observe such conditions with the attitude that they don't constitute a problem for us, but are simply a necessary component of life with this body. It's not necessary that we see such things as problems or obstacles. In our training, we must have a sense of restraint and tolerance. When we sit, the heart may again be prone to the five hindrances, for example, attachment to the various strands of sensuality. If one gets lost in anxieties and possessiveness over material objects, afraid they'll be lost or stolen and one will be left lacking, then such compounded thoughts will steal away one's sense of determination. As such, we cast aside such external matters. Such matters are like the outer layers of bark, not the heartwood, and won't lead us to peace, to santi. So we cut them off and throw them aside. We learn to regard disagreeable physical feelings and discomforts as simply ordinary affairs of the body. We have to experience pain and sickness because they are a natural part of the ordinary state of all conditioned things, and as such, they cannot be avoided. With this determined mindset, we strive to abandon the hindrances, including the various khandamaras, in order to be free from concerns, free of the worries that tarnish the mind. We apply our determination to practicing with diligence, to fulfilling our responsibility of building the causes for knowing and seeing, the causes for santi. Actually, we already have all of the component parts necessary for our practice. It's not the case that we don't have what we need. But the reason that our practice has not yet come to fulfillment is because our mindfulness and clear comprehension are deficient. These two qualities are of great support. They are supportive in giving rise to alertness and self-awareness, which is not an easy matter because of the distracting power of the mind's objects. Therefore, we should work at building up mindfulness and clear comprehension. Previously, we've allowed the mind to freely follow its objects, which arouse and incite, not allowing it a stable base. Now we try to build up mindfulness and wisdom by taking up a single mental object as a basis for the struggle. There are obstacles, but we build up a sense of determination and apply our best effort. Focusing our attention on a single object brings energy to our practice and gives it a solid foundation. It also provides a strong defense against the various distractions. The meditation object that we take as a basis for developing self-awareness is something which exists within this bodily formation as one of its elements. The wind element, which we breathe in and breathe out, makes a suitable means for bringing the mind to peace, free from the hindrances, ready for the practice of vipassana, or insight. When one pays one's respects before sitting meditation, one should say to oneself, "At this time, I will watch over, supervise, and take care of the mind, warding off all of its formless attackers." Those attackers are the mental phenomena which arise according to causes and conditions. They have no form, but nevertheless must be dealt with. Dealing with them requires the use of a refined, solid, and firm mental object. Having selected the breathing process as our object, we focus on knowing the in and out breath. When we breathe in, we know we are breathing in. When we breathe out, we know we are breathing out. We have a feeling of being with both the in and out breath. We must be sure not to allow obstructive things to come in and block the way. Don't let them stumble into this protected area. Ordinarily, if we've come so far as abandoning the various kinds of worries that tend to arise, we're apt to lose our attention and allow the hindrance of drowsiness to take over. We must maintain awareness and keep the activity of mind clearly in focus. Its thoughts and feelings, impressions and formations can cause us to slip up and lose our awareness. We then get caught in a mood or a mode of thinking, or get distracted by external objects by way of the ears or the eyes. If our awareness isn't firmly established, we can be led off, away from the path, and then beset by the hindrances on all sides. Proliferation, irritation, restlessness, doubt, and hesitation. Even sensations of aches and pains, as if the body is breaking. The urge to urinate, the urge to defecate. Feelings of sluggishness and unwillingness to make the effort. All of these things come up. If we don't have strong determination of mind, such things can carry us away. We should apply our decisiveness of mind. When such symptoms arise, we must quell them with the use of a parikama, or meditation word. We bring it up as a nimitta, a sign in the mind. Without making a sound, but by setting up a sign in the conscious mind, we recite Bud on the in-breath and To on the out-breath. Once we've worked hard to establish Buddho thoroughly, fully, and completely, there will be no such thing as obstacles or obstructions. We then change our focus and give attention to the mind and its objects. We rely on that self-awareness which truly knows with alertness and readiness. But most commonly, problems will overwhelm us at this point. Because we loosen the reins, we slacken our effort. Easing up our attention, craving infiltrates and takes a hold. If we don't slacken our effort and don't let craving take over, there will be no problem. We shift our attention to the mind and focus on knowing what mind consciousness is. It may seem that we refer to the mind as a material object, but in fact it is not. The process of consciousness is the immaterial function of the mind receiving impressions of the senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mental formations. We observe this sense consciousness and recognize it simply as just one part of the material and immaterial components that we take as a self. The knowledge which arises from observing the mind strengthens our awareness, and our sense of readiness. The knowledge which arises from observing the mind strengthens our awareness and our sense of readiness to respond. We don't follow the unwholesome mind, we dismiss it. We follow the wholesome mind, which supports those components that create a sense of destroying the world of self. We investigate all of the functions of the mind, recognizing them as impersonal, observing them without grasping them as this or that. If the mind is wholesome, it will seek to simplify and reduce. It will clear away waste, not permitting feelings of owning or being to arise. The wholesome mind engages its objects with awareness. It doesn't engage without awareness. Self-awareness is present. As a result, our practice gives rise to increasing firmness and strength. Just as rice seeds, having been scattered throughout the field with all the supportive environmental conditions of rain, water, fertilizer, atmosphere, sunshine, and the correct timing, will not succumb to disease, but will sprout, flourish, and develop strength and immunity, so too, this practice flourishes in the same way. One's awareness is well established in every mind moment, and one has a feeling of resolution and courage. There's no concern for external things such as the body. No matter how long one sits, there's no cause for concern. One doesn't see it as something of importance. One views seeing and knowing, the state of seeing and knowing, as the thing of importance. Because it is there that one feels that such various problems can be cut off, where one's experience of such problems will be ended. This, then, is one cause for the arising of knowledge and vision. The Buddha taught that we should maintain mindful awareness at the moment of sitting, at the moment of observing, at the moment of knowing, and at the moment of seeing. When we are observing or knowing, what is that like? When we see, what is that like? Having seen, what do we take away with us? True seeing, the Buddha said, is seeing with right view, seeing with emptiness, free from grasping and attachment. When we see mental objects, we see them as insubstantial and unbeneficial for achieving peace. Therefore, we set them down and don't engage with them any further. The mental objects are thus put to rest according to the level of our practice. As far as our practice develops, the mental objects are quenched to that level. Our practice distinguishes the mind from its objects, the mind objects from the mind. As such, the knower, the seer, and the be-er are viewed as separate aspects. They exist together as states of knowing, seeing, and being, and that can be observed in this process. There is the method of our practice, the state of seeing, and the state of being. This is what he's referring to is in Thai, the disciples of Lungpur Cha La, they say Ru Hen Ben. It's knowing Dhamma, seeing Dhamma, being Dhamma, but he's stating it in another way. There is the method of our practice, the state of seeing, and the state of being. Once this distinction is made, there is nothing that can stain the mind. The state of the mind and its object can be recognized and identified. The knower is the one who knows the mind as the mind, and the mind object as the mind object. Mental objects are therefore not capable of causing the knower to err or stumble off after them. This is the kind of knowledge which arises. One sees each object of the mind as empty of substance, as mere deceit, mere delusion, something meaningless, like a child's toy. One doesn't see it as having any value. One's inclination is to set such things down, lay down the mental objects. Delight in the mental objects doesn't occur. Dislike for mental objects also doesn't occur. There is peace. This is the peace of seclusion. Just as in the nighttime, there is seclusion. Seclusion from people coming and going. Without people around, it is quiet and peaceful. This is just the same. Although our faculty of perception is still in place, mental phenomena simply don't take over. One exists in a state of emptiness, with equanimity, free from self. There is no being, no person, no liking or disliking, no love, no hate or anger. It's a cool and refreshing abiding with a feeling of great peace and seclusion. This experience is Santi, the peace of Santi. Awareness is still present and complete, but one has no desire or thirst, like a traveler who has reached their destination and set down their load. One isn't thirsty, one is without thirst. There is no such word as thirst, it doesn't exist. Everything shifts and goes to a state of peace. Self-awareness was the instigator of this process of development. Now, when mental objects appear, our awareness is in place, so they present no danger. If one faces obstructions, hindrances, and difficulties in this practice and finds oneself unable to see or understand, it's because the determination of mind isn't sufficient. The sweeping and dusting, wiping and mopping hasn't been done. The feeling of firmness hasn't been achieved. It's as if one's dwelling place isn't clean. One feels apprehensive in such a place, but once it is clean, one feels confident and unafraid. Therefore, as time passes, we try to achieve this. It's not a difficult matter. The Buddha taught that when one practices to the point of attaining dasanti, meaning peace and seclusion from mental defilements by having cut them off completely, one will then live with a feeling of self-worth, brightness of heart, wakefulness, and cheerfulness. Nothing will cause any feeling of impurity or suffering. Even when the bodily formation undergoes change, it's only the elements of nature which change. The state of the internal experience remains unaffected. This is something we must try to achieve. It is a goal which is not near, yet not far. This can be understood when we read about the four foundations of mindfulness, the qualities of a Dhamma practitioner, practicing for the sake of knowledge and vision. We can see that the Buddha said, if one practices continually without letting up one's mindfulness, one can expect results according to the following timeline. If progress is quick, within 7 days. On the moderate level, 7 months. And in the slowest case, 7 years. This is the time allocation the Buddha gave. It may be only a framework which he outlined, but if we practice continually in this way, then we must surely have the opportunity to attain results. We should give serious thought to this and put forth much effort. If we don't do it or feel we can't do it, that's foolish, really foolish. Because the Buddha's teaching is not something we are unable to practice. It's something we are entirely able to practice, and that's why we should make the effort. When sitting meditation, try to stay with the object. Try to pacify other things which arise. Don't grasp at states of concentration, samadhi. Simply aim to pacify arising objects. That much is enough. It's enough to give rise to a feeling of motivated energy just by putting such objects to peace. If you have difficulties, it's because of the thicket of obstacles and illusions that are rooted in the past. These thoughts and memories will insist that they belong to yourself, unsettling you to the point that you feel you can't sit or stand still. You perceive no peacefulness, only frustration, restlessness, and agitation. This is particularly the case for those who come to ordain for a limited time period. One feels one has already achieved one's goal of ordaining and left simply waiting for time to run its course. Negative thoughts and feelings inevitably arise. These feelings are an obstacle to one's practice, to fulfilling one's responsibility. But in spite of these things, we must make the effort to train. I also trained, for a period, as one newly come to the Dhamma and discipline, according to tradition. But doing the practice soon helped me to see its value. However, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't see any sign of peace or any sign of happiness. All I saw was chaos and frustration. As for peace and seclusion, there was no sign. Sitting down, it was as if I found myself in the most dangerous of places. There was no coming to grips with my feelings, either sitting or standing. It was a great ordeal. But still I had the feeling that, when the Buddha taught, he didn't teach for any personal gain. He taught only in terms of things that he himself had already experienced. So I made the effort to determine my mind. I would think to myself, whatever must be done today, that is what I'll do. Whatever must be done day by day, according to the time and opportunity, that's what one should do. My first attempts, when all is said and done, didn't get me anywhere. I didn't know what I was doing, therefore my efforts weren't effective. I was practicing like a trader with no skills, who uses only brute force. In the Isan language, they call such a person a two-fisted tradesman. I was simply putting forth effort, not knowing whether or not I would succeed. When the time came for sitting, I would sit. But I didn't see any peace within. All I saw was chaos and memories. Images and ideas kept building up in my mind. As I sat, sometimes desire would pull me into developing schemes and projects, as if I must lay a plan to achieve this or that. One moment I was building up an idea, the next moment it would collapse and disintegrate. That's the way it felt. Should I ever act upon such thinking, the proliferation would go on and on without stopping, both day and night. But I kept on making the effort to practice. Even if there were to be no results, I had to keep trying, keep persevering with the patient endurance. This is the point where one must dig for the treasure. But having dug in, if there is only dry earth, no sign of treasure, the earth is hard and there are rocks as well. One sometimes feels discouraged, but I kept on trying. Sometimes, various hindrances and memories would pull me into thinking I was hopeless and out of luck. Sitting there like one with no sense and no mindfulness, wondering what it's all for. But even so, I kept on trying, and when I looked back at the past efforts I had accumulated, it became an increasing source of inspiration. That's about halfway. It's almost 7 o'clock. I'll continue tomorrow.